Clinical research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 3 years has shared with us her decades' research into political assassinations and abuses of power in this country. Her program relates the news of the week to emerging evidence about the conspiracy which allegedly maintains by force its control over the legislative and judicial processes in America. And now, here's Mae.
Good afternoon. This is Dialogue Conspiracy, program number 173. It's December the 2nd, 1974, in Carmel, California. A nice rainy afternoon. Not cold, but rainy. I want to spend the bulk of today's program talking about a new book, Whitewash 4, by Harold Weisberg. Harold Weisberg has written 3 books on the Kennedy assassination. This is his 4th book, and he's also written a book on the Martin Luther King assassination. And I want to go into his new book. He sent it to me this week, and I want to share a lot of the information as much as we have time for on the program today. There were a few other items I wanted to run down briefly in the news that pertain to political assassinations and conspiracies. One was an account in the morning newspaper that the mafia was hired to kill President Marcos. 2 persons have been arrested and named as assassins or potential assassins of Marcos. The first plan to kill him was in February 1972, and the killing included doing it at the time that Indonesian President Suharto was visiting Manila. I thought this was interesting, the report that the mafia was used to hire Marcos, because where the U.S. government has sent the CIA to murder heads of states all around the world, we never send in a CIA agent directly that just stands up, puts them before a firing squad, or shoots these various people. We have a team that hides behind another team, and just like you watched in the Watergate, the money washing that goes through 7 operations, this is the way our Central Intelligence Agency works, so that they're never fingered directly for the assassination. Well, I take that back. They are fingered and accused, but it's hard to pin it to them because there's so many ways of cutoffs to conceal the evidence of who is really behind these murders. But in the list of links that I've done on my research of conspiracy and assassinations, I have a list of 15 circles that interlock their parts of a conspiracy, if it is a government conspiracy done by the CIA or the Defense Intelligence Agency. There are usually 15 elements, though there are 15 elements done in every conspiracy that all work together, such as the Secret Service or the Protective Covenant coverage of the particular agent has to be involved, or the selected patsies that take the blame for the crime, or there's multiple gunmen that are involved. Your victim, your evidence is manipulated, your witnesses perjure themselves, and the right witnesses are not called to solve the crime. But one of those 15 links of the chain is the use of organized crime. And the American intelligence operations, the FBI and the CIA have worked very closely with organized crime in all the political assassinations, in the meetings in New Orleans, people that were involved with James Ray and Jack Ruby in the John Kennedy assassination. So it didn't come as a big surprise that the mafia had been hired to kill President Marcos. But there was some interesting sidelight in the report today. The report said the assassination attempts variously called for the use of chemical explosives dug underground along the presidential motorcade route, blasting devices concealed inside of flower pots and a flagpole stand, and guns disguised as loudspeakers on a golf course. Imagine these sophisticated weapons. It reminded me of the Watergate, when the men were arrested at the Watergate Hotel, and they had purchased floor plans for the convention rooms in Miami and air conditioning plans. And I believe it was Victor Marchetti or Fletcher Prouty who said the CIA could use vapors that would erase memories of if somebody was murdered in the room or the gun went off. There are vapors that could go through the air conditioning plants to erase the memory of what happened at that particular moment. But these are very sophisticated devices. Imagine the flagpole stand at the base. There would be flowers. And blasting devices would be at the base. And guns disguised as loudspeakers on a golf course. Well, I wonder, in counting the bullets at Dealey Plaza when John Kennedy was killed, and allegedly there were Secret Service people all around, And everybody wonders where the extra bullets came from that could have gone in the car or couldn't be accounted for at the autopsy of John Kennedy. We see now that there's even such a thing as guns disguised in loudspeakers, and that the assassination attempt would be done also when another head of state is visiting, which makes it much more terrible because you implicate that other person or associate with them with that particular death. Another item in the news this week, yesterday, December the 1st, was a report from Senator Sam Ervin's committee, the Subcommittee on Constitutional Rights. There's a 650-page report I've sent for it today. You might want to write to the Senate Subcommittee on Constitutional Rights, Senator Sam Ervin, and see if you can get access to a 651-page report. It seems that the federal government has been financing experiments to control human behavior. Well, those of you that listen to Dialogue Conspiracy every week for the last several years know for 2 years I've been trying to study the methods by which the federal government has been financing the experiment of behavior, what doctors are doing it, what hospitals seem to be doing this. And now the admission, there's this large study that's come out with the admission that the federal government does brain surgery, it alters behavior with drugs and with computers, and it also mentions radio transplants implanted in the heads and other means. Now, the committee in the Senate said there's the absence of strict controls. They use mind-altering techniques on child molesters, shoplifters, hyperactive children, and other antisocial persons. Now, I maintain through my research that mind-altering techniques, surgery, and hypnosis and drugs have been used in every one of the major political assassinations, as well as much of the violence that we're seeing on the streets today. The psychosurgery is done without review controls. And here is something else. The departments and agencies in the government that are doing this include Health, Education, and Welfare, the Veterans Administration, the Defense Department, Labor Department, and the National Science Foundation. It doesn't say where that is located. Also in Florida, there's a group called The Seed, where they take children who have been hippies or dropouts, and they turn these students into seedlings. And the federal government has programmed them in a way they no longer have drugs, but they're very straight and quiet. Their hair is short, and they walk around in their particular school. These seedlings have been experimented upon, and they're described like robots. And they're trained to inform on each other, similar to Nazi Germany, and they run in daily. They're programmed to use the telephone daily, and they report against each other. This reminded me of the allegations in Chile right now that they're building concentration camps for 800,000 children, young adults, to be taken from their families. These are persons whose parents supported Allende, and they want to do mind alteration on these people. The congressional report mentions Vacaville, California, the use of anacetin, but that's a drug that causes a seizure of the respiratory system and muscular paralysis. Now, I have a copy of two articles regarding this kind of psychosurgery. One pertains to a man who's at Folsom Prison right now by the name of James Boyd Mackey, M-A-C-K-E-Y. He filed a $8 million lawsuit against the California prison system at Vacaville because he said that two holes were placed in his head, in the back of his head, and surgery was performed to him to change his thoughts and his sensations and speech. Mackey said the operation was performed without his informed consent or that of his parents, and he's filed a suit in the U.S. District Court for pain and injury. This was a suit filed by James Boyd Mackey. Now, this article was dated a while back in 73, and I did talk about it before, but it's hard for people to realize that the federal government admits doing these things in a study at the present time, but ignored this evidence when it first came out. But the important thing about the Mackey case is that in 1967, his name was mentioned in an article in San Rafael that he was involved in the John Kennedy assassination. He was afraid that he would be killed in San Quentin, and he had protested that his life was in danger, that he was involved some way in the John Kennedy assassination. So the solution for Mr. Mackey was to take him to Vacaville, California, and put two holes in his head and drill the back of his head and do surgery to alter his thoughts. Now, that's the kind of thing I was talking about with Robert Hyde, who's now at Chino, and the California law enforcement are covering up the plans to murder Robert Hyde. He's had a suit against the Department of Corrections because four different men were hired to murder him. But they were only on contract to murder him after he was sent to Vacaville and escaped that. I tried to save him from psychosurgery up at Vacaville, the same kind of treatment that Mackey got. And then when Hyde was saved from being turned into a robot, then there were contracts on his life. It's important to give support to the congressional investigation. It's called the Subcommittee on Constitutional Rights. So I think you should write to Sam Ervin and ask about this and ask them to halt these implants of the all kinds of surgery, but the radio implants are the important, one of the most important things, because people are being controlled beyond their will, and I believe that they're doing violence, some of them not knowing it, and they're talking with electronic equipment in their heads and are being controlled to test armies of the future, which the state and federal government admits is the purpose. A lot of this is to create robots who can go to war without protesting the war and move automatically. I suspect Mark Gabron, G-A-B-R-O-N, of having this kind of psychosurgery or treatment. He was from the Veterans Hospital in Los Angeles in September 1974. He went to Griffith Park and asked them to call the LAPD, took a few SWAT hostages with him, and then the SWAT team, the same military team that works with the police department that killed the SLA in June 1974, were up at Griffith Park, and Mark Gabron made his little moment of history. He had worked for the federal government in Vietnam. He had allegedly murdered 325 people, but he was let out of Veterans Hospital to do his little psychodrama on the hill, stop people at the golf course in the park that day, and I feel that this is a case of his mind being altered to go out and play this role. Another one that I've talked about for a long time that I believe had the electrodes implanted into his head that should be investigated is Lawrence Kwong in San Francisco. That's the gentleman that went to a private detective and said he heard voices that kept telling him to go to KGO. Kwong had killed one gentleman inside of KGO and then killed himself, but he had been to Hawaii in the company of a woman. He had an unmarked weapon, which I think belonged to the CIA. And the same syndrome between Lawrence Kwong and a lot of the scenes of California violence in Santa Cruz, the Herbert Mullen case, also in Hawaii at an army hospital. I call it the California syndrome. It may be taking place around the country, but it's important to check out who is doing the brain surgery and the computer alteration and the electrode implants, if there is a way to pinpoint the doctors in the hospital and then correlate it with violence in the community and see if these people are being turned into robots to create this violence, which is what I do believe is happening. The National Enquirer, I'm going to change that subject now and go to the National Enquirer. It has a quite large circulation. It's one of the small newspapers like the Tatler. Has an article this week. It says, Howard Hughes is alive and well, living in his own $22 million Bahama hotel. I thought it was interesting because on the newsstands in Playgirl this month, it's still on the stands, is the article I did with Stephanie Caruana saying that Howard Hughes is dead and buried off a Greek island by Onassis. The article that was submitted for December Playgirl was in 3 months in advance almost, and I'm sure that if anybody got wind of that article, they could counteract with something else. It may be a coincidence that this particular thing is out at this time, but it's an interesting article because there's no documentation or evidence that Hughes is alive or well at all. It says, Enquirer team cracks tight security and discovers Hughes is well. And it goes on to say that Hughes has not been seen publicly since 1950. But various people, waitresses and employees at the hotel, say that he's alive. And they quote a girl who's now 22 years old. She wasn't alive when Howard Hughes was seen last, and she's saying that Howard Hughes is alive. She says, I saw him with my own eyes. She says, there's stories now that Hughes is sick or crippled and even dead, but I saw him with my own eyes. Now, how would she know that was Howard Hughes when the other Howard Hughes had as many as 20 doubles who would be the same age that he is now, which is about 71? And she claims that that's the real one. She saw one. with her own eyes. She tells about going on a what she calls a mysterious 707 charter flight, which went into the Bahamas from London last year, and only three people were on the plane. Well, I assure you, if that was the real Howard Hughes and there was a mysterious plane with three people and she wasn't there for to fill in this cover story, she wouldn't have been on the plane, because the pilot of the plane that took this body from Las Vegas down to the Bahamas in 68 said, was told, if you look back, three men and four men told him, if you look back in the plane and see the passenger, you'll be shot. You'll never be alive to tell the story. So the pilot never saw who was on his plane. So I can't imagine a mysterious plane with just three passengers, a Boeing 707, would have two men, Howard Hughes, and a 20-year-old woman who never saw Hughes. As I say, she wasn't born when he disappeared. And she said there were three people on the plane. The article goes on to tell about the customs officials who say that a man did fly in, but he can't verify that it's Hughes. And a doctor has said Hughes is in great shape, but this man has not stepped forward. He isn't named. The doctor isn't named, and there's no evidence in here at all that Hughes is alive. It says that there's two bodyguards that have .38 revolvers and two-way radios, and somebody allegedly uses up on top of this hotel. They've got closed-circuit TV cameras and guards in the duplex and the offices. The elevator goes only two stories below, two floors, and no one else gets above, and the guards have special keys, and nobody has really seen him. So this young 20-year-old is the basis of an article that talks about that he's alive and well, which I really believe is counteracting our story that Hughes was buried. Well, last week in the news, we brought up on Dialogue Conspiracy, I talked about the FBI report, the CIA report, the quotation of Alan Dulles from the Warren Commission meeting of January the 27th, which has been declassified, where he said the CIA and the FBI would lie to the Warren Commission. If they were called to testify, they would lie to the Warren Commission. They would not lie to the President of the United States, but they wouldn't think anything of lying to everybody else. And if they were asked if Oswald was an agent or employee of the FBI, was he an agent, they would definitely say no. And if they were asked, was he an employee of the CIA, they would definitely say no, that they wouldn't think twice about it, that Alan Dulles was the former head of the CIA. He was removed from the CIA by John Kennedy, who wanted to blow the agency to bits and throw it to the wind. And Alan Dulles was on the Warren Commission, and he was in charge of collecting the evidence of Lee Harvey Oswald, who happened to be an agent of the Central Intelligence Agency through Navy intelligence. But the main orders for Oswald came through the National Security Council. He was a very important person in government intelligence. I charted for 8 years Oswald's relationship to all the various branches of the intelligence service, and I'll read off a few of those to you, and then I want to read you a section of Gerald Ford's book that he wrote on the Warren meetings, the Warren Commission meetings, his secret meeting, where they got evidence that Oswald was an agent of the FBI and the CIA. And then I want to read you some of Harold Weisberg's book that came in hope that as many of you as can afford it will buy it. You have to appreciate the background of Lee Harvey Oswald to see how important this meeting was of the Warren Commission, the January 23rd meeting and January 27th. Now, the 27th meeting had been declassified just recently. There was a lawsuit for many years on the Freedom of Information Act by Harold Weisberg. He went up through every channel up to the Supreme Court to get the many meetings of the Warren Commission and other evidence, and he was turned down. And then all of a sudden, for some reason, last June, the National Archives mailed him and declassified the meeting of January the 27th of the Warren Commission. And these meetings, I have minutes of some of their meetings, and they're just fascinating. I think the amazing thing about the meetings of the Warren Commission is how simple-minded these men on the commission are. You think of it, a prestigious committee with John Cooper, a senator, and Hale Boggs from Louisiana, another senator, and Richard Russell, and John J. McCloy, president of the World Bank, built up Germany after World War II, and Gerald Ford on the Warren Commission, and Earl Warren, the Chief Justice of the United States. And Alan Dulles, who was head of the intelligence agencies and formed the CIA after the OSS, you have a list of prestigious men, and when you hear their conversations, they're absolute idiots. And it's like the White House tapes of Richard Nixon with Haldeman and Ehrlichman or John Dean, the conversations that don't seem to make sense, that seem childish. And the minutes of the Warren Commission meetings of these very prominent men that affect the world, that move the world, the power they have, is just fascinating. And this book by Harold Weisberg, it's called Whitewash 4, is the bulk of this book is that January 27th meeting, and he has a lot more information in it. Incidentally, that book, it's ordered, you can buy it, Route 8, Frederick, Maryland, 21701, and it's $6.25. That includes the mail. I think I read off last week, Harold Weisberg, Whitewash 4. Well, the Warren Commission met Gerald Ford's book on called The Mind of the Assassin. He described the meeting of the Warren Commission where they got information that Lee Harvey Oswald was an agent of the FBI. His book begins, this is the way Gerald Ford's book begins, "No sooner had the commission investigating President Kennedy's assassination assembled its staff and tentatively outlined methods of operation when it was plunged into an outstanding problem. On Wednesday, January 22nd, the members of the commission were hurriedly called into emergency session. The caller was Mr. Wagoner Carr, the Attorney General of Texas. The information was that the FBI had an undercover agent, and the agent was none other than Lee Harvey Oswald, the alleged assassin of President Kennedy. Prior to that day, the newspapers carried inconspicuous articles or two speculating whether Oswald could have been an agent of the U.S. government. Mrs. Margaret Oswald made statements that her son must have been tied with the CIA or the State Department. But now high officials from the Dallas prosecutor, Henry Wade, reported the rumor he himself had been a former FBI man. So on the 22nd of January at 5:30 p.m. in the Veteran of Foreign Wars building, this meeting was attended. And Gerald Ford says, "I cannot recall attending a meeting more tense or hushed. The commission made the decision to ask the Texas Attorney General, District Attorney Wade, and other Dallas officials who had knowledge of the allegations to come at once to Washington and secretly present what they heard. There should be absolutely no publicity. The Texas officials slipped into the nation's capital with complete anonymity. They met with Lee Rankin and other members of the staff, and they told what they knew. The information was that Oswald was hired by the FBI. Incidentally, he was hired in September 62. He came home from Russia in 1962. His undercover agent number was 179. He was on the payroll at $200 a month starting in 62, and he was still on their payroll the day that he was apprehended in the Texas theater, the day that John Kennedy was murdered. He was still on the payroll. The New York Times got wind that Lee Harvey Oswald was an agent and point blank asked the FBI if it was true, and the FBI denied any possible connection with Oswald." This is Gerald Ford's book, but he doesn't tell you that at the same meeting they admitted that the FBI or the CIA would lie to the Warren Commission. They wouldn't tell the truth. They would deny it no matter what. Gerald Ford mentioned an article in Nation magazine that said Oswald was an agent of the FBI, and Nation magazine had given their reasons. A man named Lonnie Hudkins in Houston, Texas, had written in the Houston Post, January the 1st, 1964, that it was rumored that Oswald was an agent for the United States government. Everybody involved or close to the scene was approached by the FBI, and they were told to keep their mouth shut. Oswald had lived well, this is Gerald Ford's book, had lived well for a man who couldn't hold a job. He had money to spend on projects his salary couldn't justify. A story was printed that the Western Union office was sending him regular money orders. Could the FBI pay him off for his undercover work? The Western Union refused to make its records public. The Western Union also admitted that Oswald was sending messages out regularly from the Western Union. He was supposed to put aside $1,500 when he left the Marine Corps to go to Russia. This was quite a lot of money to go to Helsinki. It was a substantial saving for an ordinary soldier, and one shouldn't overlook the possibility he was subsidized by the CIA and FBI. This is Gerald Ford's book. He mentions Oswald going to his secretary, Pauline Bates, when he came home from the Soviet Union. And he hinted that he had been there as a secret agent. And also, he had handed out leaflets for Fair Play for Cuba down in New Orleans. But where did the money come for the leaflets and the money for the office? And it goes into this subject. And Gerald Ford talked about the trips to Mexico, his wandering in Mexico, his journeys, his Whale Hill Globetrotter, and unrestricted life, and he was supposed to be a laborer without a skill. Gerald Ford talks about Alan Dulles at the meeting and the best way to handle the rumor, and he suggested going to the head of the FBI and the CIA, and later we find out that they agreed, or he agrees at the meeting, that they would indeed lie if they were asked about it. The book by Gerald Ford begins with the problem of Oswald being an agent of the FBI and the CIA, and that's the area of research that I spent 8 years cross-filing of the Warren Commission hearings. At that meeting, Earl Warren said, "We must go into this thing from both ends, from the end of the rumor mongers and from the end of the FBI, and if we come to a cul-de-sac, there we are, but we can report on it." But what the Warren Commission did was not what Gerald Ford said they agreed to do. In his book, on page 25, the Portrait of an Assassin, Gerald Ford, it was the consensus of all seven men that the only way to proceed was to conduct extensive and thorough hearings of as many witnesses as was necessary to exhaust not just this rumor, but dozens of other rumors. Where doubts were cast on any United States agency, independent experts would be hired and the investigation conducted in such a way to avoid reliance on a questioned authority. Now, Gerald Ford, in his own book, said the consensus of the Warren Commission was to proceed with extensive and thorough hearings to exhaust what could be a rumor or investigate it. Wherever there were doubts on any U.S. agency, like the FBI or CIA, independent investigators would be hired, and they would proceed there. And then Gerald Ford goes ahead and writes a book on Lee Harvey Oswald after this introduction, in which every word in there is testimony from witnesses that is perjury, it's untrue, it has no basis in fact. The book is a complete hoax. It doesn't describe Lee Harvey Oswald at all, where there's accumulated evidence that Oswald was in fact an agent of the FBI and CIA. Now, there were three sources of rumors, or that these came from, three sources of information that Oswald was an agent of the FBI and CIA. One was from Alonzo Hudkins, as I say, from the Washington Post, dated January the 1st, 1964. That came out in Washington Post. The next source was Alan Sweet, who wrote about it. He was the chief criminal deputy sheriff for Dallas County Jail. He also was the man who in charge of opening all of Jack Ruby's mail when Jack Ruby was arrested. And it was Alan Sweet who sent out documents that Oswald was an employee of the FBI. And the third source of the information was Bill Alexander, the Dallas assistant district attorney. And another source of information was Joe Donahill, and it came out at the time of Jack Ruby's arrest when Jack Ruby was in jail. And Joe Donahill was Jack Ruby's attorney. And Jack Ruby had information that the man that he shot in the Dallas Police Department was, in fact, an agent of the FBI. And he might have known at the time the CIA, too, but at least of the FBI. Now, the Warren Commission, the witnesses that were called before the Warren Commission are listed in Volume 15 of the 26 volumes of the hearings before the commission on the assassination of President Kennedy. Mr. Hudkins was never called as a witness. Alan Sweet was never called as a witness. Bill Alexander was never called as a witness. And Joe Tannehill was never called as a witness. So the sources of the information on the background of Lee Oswald being of the CIA and FBI were not exhausted by the Warren Commission. And Gerald Ford tells you in his book that the decision was made that all these people would be investigated or come as witnesses. Not one of them was under sworn testimony, for even the chance to perjure themselves wasn't offered. Not one of them was questioned by the Warren Commission. And the man in charge of covering this up to keep the rumor quiet was Leon Jaworski. He was part of the team. As I say, Hudkins and Sweet and Alexander never appeared before the Warren Commission, but the man in charge of representing the state of Texas or the CIA working with the Warren Commission was Leon Jaworski, the prosecutor of the Watergate case, who kept the lid on the Watergate. Now, the whole problem that the Warren Commission had was to wipe out the rumor. They took testimony from no witnesses. They agreed to call the men from Texas. They were never questioned under oath. They admitted in their meetings they would be discussed secretly. The minutes of the meeting says we'll talk to them secretly. And they never did kill this rumor. Now, I did, as I say, 8 years of research into Oswald's background. Some of the areas that I went into just mentioned briefly was his entering the Marines, the way he entered the Marines. His brothers were in the service, his training in electronics, in radar, his assignment in the Philippines at Asugi Air Base, where the U-2, the home of the U-2 flights, and Gary Powers mentions Oswald as possibly bringing his plane down, which ended the summit conference of Khrushchev and Eisenhower. There's records of Oswald's Russian language training in the Marines before he went to the Soviet Union. He had a classified secret clearance, top secret security clearances, doing his radar work. He was recommended as officer material. He met plainclothes man at El Toro base before he left for Europe, received books with a seal, a large amount of money. He was given an honorable discharge. He left for Europe, Albert Schweitzer School, allegedly, but arrived in Helsinki. He had unusual help to get to the Soviet Union. Oswald worked with John Snyder at the Soviet Embassy, American Embassy, agent of the CIA. Marina Oswald worked with Mr. McVicker out of the U.S. Embassy in Moscow, CIA. Oswald called a press conference where he met with Priscilla Johnson and members of the CIA over in the Soviet Union. He worked in a radio factory. I've talked about the man who ran that factory. His background is very questionable of possible links to Nazis and the Galen operation. Oswald worked at a photographic lab that did government clearance maps and government papers and bonds in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, Jagger's Chili Stovall. Oswald's entire background was with the Central Intelligence Agency and Naval Intelligence, Defense Intelligence Agencies. Marina Oswald was kept by the Secret Service after the assassination and was in contact with the very first man who met Oswald when he returned from the Soviet Union, Mr. Gregory. Marguerite Oswald had gone to Washington in 61 and told them her son was in the CIA. It was time for him to come home. 3 weeks later, the U.S. Embassy had reached Oswald, and he sent a letter, "Send me money and my passport. I'm ready to come home." Oswald is married to an intelligence agent, was married. Marina Oswald, it was a marriage of a husband and wife espionage team. They returned back to the Dallas-Fort Worth area where they used certain code names like Aunt Valiant, Volva, that they used also in the Soviet Union where they were sending photographs and letters back and forth. They used the same code names from Minsk to Moscow that they used from Dallas to Fort Worth. Marina Oswald came into the United States and was given the red carpet treatment at the port with an agent who's active in the Anti-Communist League. They went through passports easily, were met in a limousine, handled their arrangements at the hotel in an office, and then put them on a plane like VIP to the Dallas-Fort Worth area. The evidence that Oswald was an agent comes through everything that he did, every person he met, every oil engineer, the chief of security at Convair, the people that he was seeing in New Orleans, the man he was sitting on the bus with going down to Mexico, that Albert Osborne, John Howard Bowen we spoke about. So I, getting back to the Weisberg book and the meeting of the Warren Commission, you can see what a hot potato they had, because every single thing that had to do with Lee Harvey Oswald indicated that he had been an agent of the CIA and of the FBI. And here, John Kennedy was only dead. It was November 22nd, 1963, till January the 1st, 1964, which is a week and a half, and it was blabbed, beginning to blab in Europe, coming from TASS and the Soviet intelligence saying that they were CIA agents while they were over in that country. It was coming from Paris. The evidence was coming from Jack Ruby. It was coming from the Sheriff's Department in Dallas, Texas. So the evidence that Oswald was an agent of the FBI and the CIA was spilling out in a lot of places, and it was a masterful feat to keep this hidden so many years that it's seeping out now in new documents that are coming to the front. They're being declassified. There's enough existing now without new documents coming out to show the relationship of Oswald to all of the intelligence systems, the Navy Intelligence, the Department of Immigration, State Department, the CIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, his contacts, and to the FBI, go through all of my research, and I have about 28,000 typewritten pages of cross-filing on just the chain of command of Lee and Marina Oswald. So knowing that much about Oswald, it's interesting to look back at the meeting that they had on the 27th. It's similar to the meeting in the White House, the tapes that are being revealed now of Richard Nixon. The Watergate was June 17th, and the June 25th meeting was just a week later. And the frantic position of what they were going to do, how they were going to cover up Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Richard Nixon, how they were going to keep the lid on, how they were going to stonewall. The Watergate broke down faster than the John Kennedy assassination. It only took till March, when James McCord started to talk, that the Watergate really began to spill over. But the tapes show how frantic the people involved were to keep things on and to call in the CIA to lie and cover or cover all their traces, to use the FBI to cover. And the major part of the Watergate is still as covered up as the John Kennedy assassination. So the minutes of the meeting on January the 27th, 1964, that are printed in Harold Weisberg's book are as interesting as the tapes of the White House after the Watergate, the same frantic kind of what will we do, how will we cover it, when the information came in. And I thought, we just have about 7 minutes left, I thought I'd read a few pages of Harold Weisberg's book of the minutes of the meeting. This is the Warren Commission meeting discussing Oswald's being an agent of the FBI or CIA. Because just 11 years after reading many, many books and thousands of pages, the subject came up, which was in my mind all these years, about the role of the Justice Department and Robert Kennedy in the political assassination. We had an unusual situation because the Justice Department, the Attorney General, allegedly is over the acting head of the FBI. He's supposed to give the orders to the head of the FBI. But in Washington, D.C., there was a struggle going on between Robert Kennedy and J. Edgar Hoover, similar to the one between Henry Kissinger and Haldeman, Robert Haldeman. There was a power play, a struggle play. Hoover hated Robert Kennedy. He called him a little punk. In fact, the day of the assassination, he pulled out the plugs that connected his phone to Robert Kennedy's after John Kennedy was killed and said, "I don't have to answer the call of that little punk anymore." And Robert Kennedy was the Attorney General, and he was involved with solving the crime of a president being killed. And yet here was a unique position, because the president was his own brother. And the subject comes up at this meeting on whether Oswald is an agent of what to do about it. And John J. McCloy said, "I would like to examine again this relationship between the Department of Justice and the FBI." You see, there you have Robert Kennedy versus J. Edgar Hoover. "Just why would it be embarrassing for the Attorney General of the United States to inquire of one of his agencies whether or not these men who were alleged to have killed the President of the United States had an agent, was an agent?" John J. McCloy said, "Does the embarrassment supersede the importance of getting the best evidence in such a situation as this?" John J. McCloy says, "What's so embarrassing about Robert Kennedy, the Attorney General, asking the agency whether or not one of their agents killed the President?" Well, does the embarrassment supersede the importance? Well, the embarrassment obviously would be on the part of the FBI if J. Edgar Hoover said, "Yes, my agent shot your brother." That would be terribly embarrassing. And John J. McCloy is saying, "Well, what is this embarrassment? The Attorney General should look into this." Then Senator Cooper, along those lines, said that some crazy people would translate it from his official position, meaning Robert Kennedy, to a personal position, that he'd be seeking vendetta against J. Edgar Hoover. Cooper said, "It may sound far-fetched, but he would be implying as a person that something was wrong. You can't overlook the implication." In other words, what is Robert Kennedy going to do if he investigates the FBI? He's implying something's wrong with the FBI. And John J. McCloy said, "I think that would perhaps be an element in this thing, but it still wouldn't divert me from asking this man, who happens to be the Attorney General, whose sworn duty it is to enforce justice, to ask him just what is within his knowledge in regard to such a serious thing like this. It is an awkward affair, as you said the other day, but truth is our only client." Well, it turns out the truth wasn't their only client, because they did go along with the position of not questioning J. Edgar Hoover, of letting him just sign a piece of paper saying that Oswald was not an agent. The subject, John J. McCloy, said to Alan Dulles, this thing is going to build up about the story about Oswald being CIA and FBI. I got a call from Time Life. And Alan Dulles says, how do you disprove that a fellow was not your agent? How do you disprove it? Dulles was the head of the CIA at one time, and Oswald was an agent of theirs. He says, how are you going to disprove it not? And Boggs said, you could disprove it, couldn't you? And Dulles says, no, I never know how to disprove it. Boggs said, did you have agents about that you had no record whatsoever? And Alan Dulles says, the record may never be on paper. On paper, we would have hieroglyphics, and only two people would know what they meant, and nobody outside the agency would know. But they say, well, let's take a specific case like Powers, Gary Powers. And Alan Dulles is splitting hairs. He says he wasn't an agent. He was an employee. We had a signed contract with him. And Boggs said, well, Powers, did he have a signed contract? Was he recruited by the CIA? Would he say who recruited him? Could we find out? And Dulles says, well, we wouldn't tell. They're under oath, and we don't tell under oath who's under in the CIA. We wouldn't tell it. Would you tell it to your own chief? Well, we might or we might not, but he wasn't sure. And Mr. Dulles said, I think under any circumstances, I think Mr. Hoover would say certainly he didn't have anything to do with this fellow. McCloy said, Mr. Hoover didn't have anything to do with him, but his agent did. Did you directly or indirectly employ him? And Alan Dulles says, well, if he says no, there's no more we can do. We can't zero in on it. If they just say no, and Alan Dulles admitted, this was the meeting where he admitted that they wouldn't tell the truth about whether or not Oswald was an agent. There was a funny incident here where they were talking about, would you have somebody so incompetent as Lee Harvey Oswald? And incidentally, he was not incompetent. And Alan Dulles says, well, he was a stupid fellow. We wouldn't have probably used him anyway. And John J. McCloy said, I wouldn't put confidence in the intelligence of all the agents I run into. I run into awfully stupid agents. And Dulles said, not this irresponsible. McCloy said, I can't say I've run into a fellow comparable to Oswald, but I've some limited mentalities in the FBI and CIA. Earl Warren said, the underagents, the regular agents, I think they're all right, but their other agencies do employ cover men who are of a terrible character. And Alan Dulles says, terribly bad characters. And Senator Russell says, limited intelligence. Even the city police departments do it. And Earl Warren says, it almost takes that kind of a man to do this undercover work. They're limited intelligence. And Alan Dulles says, they have to be fairly smart. They may not be of a high moral character, but they ought to be fairly smart. And McCloy says, but you couldn't base an argument on the fact that the man, because he has no intelligence, hasn't been retained by the CIA or FBI. Alan Dulles was saying that Oswald was stupid, which, in fact, he was not. He had mastered electronics, radar for the whole Western Division of the Marines. They had to change the radar system, allegedly, when he went to the Soviet Union. He mastered the Russian language before he went over there. He hardly needed an interpreter. He had skills in photographic work at the photographic lab. Oswald was skilled in radar, electronics, language, and photographic work. He could have been an interpreter. But the cover story always was that he was stupid. So Dulles admits in the meetings that he may not have any moral character, but he should be smart. And they're saying, well, most of the agents, even the police department, aren't always that smart. The book that I'm referring to is it's called Whitewash for The Time Goes So Quickly. It's hard to read all the minutes of the meetings. If you can't afford $6.25 to order it from Harold Weisberg and read it for yourself, then if you want me to read some more of it on the air, some more minutes of the meeting of January the 27th, I will. I think it is a good insight to how the Warren Commission thinks. They go into the subject of the extra bullet in John Kennedy's neck, the conflicting autopsy reports, the bullet that went in finger length and didn't come out, and how are they going to handle this divergent evidence. They talk about these things, and yet the Warren Report comes out. The bullets cover. They go into the subject about Ruth Payne and Marina Oswald. And then at the end of the meeting, they say, when are you going to have another meeting? And Boggs said, John J. McCloy said, I'm leaving the country February 5th, but I'll be back for a week. He said, the plot thickens, doesn't it? and the meeting is adjourned. That's a January 27th meeting. The plot thickened because they brought up the discrepancies of the bullet, the lying of Marina Oswald regarding the rifle, Oswald's trip out of Mexico, Oswald being under the FBI and CIA. The meeting ended January 27th, but the Warren Report came out in September with the same conclusions that they began with, that Oswald was a lone assassin. The book you should get is Whitewash 4 by Harold Weisberg. That's it for today. I'll see you next week on Dialogue Conspiracy.
This has been Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 10 years has been researching the facts behind political assassinations and conspiracies in this country. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KELRB-FM in Carmel, California.